Upjack to discover more resources for living an abundant life, including books, CDs, and Catholic counseling services. Visit us online at exceptionalmarriages.com.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon.
Very good day to you. I'm Al Cresta, back for 2 hours talking about the things that matter most. And today what matters most is, of course, the recognition of the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Also, we'll have a memoir of the Iranian hostage crisis, which ended 29 years ago today. Also, there's a new Catholic response. If you recall a few weeks ago, there was a call for civility among those who are criticizing Catholic politicians. Well, now there's a late Catholic response to the call for civility. We'll talk to Austin Roos, architect of the petition. And also, interest rates down and Wall Street churning. We'll talk with George Schwartz to see if there's anything to fear on Wall Street. So all that's coming up on today's Crest in the Afternoon. Oh, one other thing, too. Since we're going to be talking about the Iranian hostage crisis, there's something that we should get out and keep in mind. The world is the world is a tough place to understand. I knew that when I was born. I still know that. It's a big, buzzing, babbling place of confusion. But we look around to try to figure out what's happening. Excuse me. And here's just a very direct statement, unambiguous statement from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Iran constitutes the single most important single country strategic challenge to the United States and to the kind of Middle East that we want to see. So, we know that the State Department thinks that Iran is the single most important single country strategic challenge. We also know that by toppling Saddam Hussein, the Bush administration has liberated, has empowered the Shiite majority in Iraq and has helped launch what has turned out to be a broad Shiite revival. Now, its next-door neighbor, Iran, is a Shiite nation. We're going to be talking to Vali Nasser, whose area of expertise is this Shia revival. And we're going to find out whether the policy currently being pursued by Washington is going to contain Iran or through a law of unintended consequences end up strengthening Shiites throughout the Middle East so that they have countervailing power to the Sunni majorities in, say, like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. So it's a fascinating story because, again, here we have religion counting in the formation of public policy. And one can argue that it was the Bush administration's lack of understanding of how deep the religious roots of the conflict in the Middle East went that led them into so many mistakes in their prosecution of the war against terrorism. In fact, I think everybody I've interviewed on this topic believes that. So we got a lot to go to today. But first, we're going to end up with the news, of course, with Nick Tom.
Thank you, Al, and a very good afternoon. This is your Ave Maria Radio News on Tuesday, January 22nd. It's the Feast of St. Vincent. Thousands of protesters are gathered today in Washington, D.C., marking a grim anniversary. Gene Culetta has more.
Here on the National Mall, pro-life demonstrators are gathered by the thousands. They're marking the 35th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, which affirmed a woman's right to an abortion. Among those here is Elizabeth Gill, a parent who came with three busloads of 7th and 8th grade Catholic school students from Erie, Pennsylvania. She hopes the Supreme Court one day reverses itself and outlaws abortion.
I pray for it.
Protesters here hold signs, including ones reading Defend Life. A van with photos of fetuses is parked on the street. After the rally here on the mall, demonstrators marched to the Supreme Court. Gene Coletta, Washington.
President Bush again spoke to the audience and said, quote, "The beating hearts that we can see on an unborn child's ultrasound come with something that we cannot see, a soul," end quote. He continued to vow to fight for unborn children by providing assistance for pregnant teens to complete their education and improving unplanned pregnancy services. Some pro-life groups decided recently to learn just how much Americans know about Roe v. Wade. Focus on the Family, Alliance Defense Fund, and Concerned Women for America teamed up to create the online Roe IQ test. More than 40,000 people took the quiz, and the average score was 59%. The results confirm that Americans do not realize the widespread impact of Roe. Focus on the Family says this just shows that Americans don't know Roe, and how can you support what you don't understand? It's a slowdown, not a recession. That's how White House Press Secretary Dana Perino describes the U.S. economy.
We've had 52 months of consecutive job growth. That's the longest stretch of job growth in the history of our country. And we want to be able to keep that going, and the president believes that a short-term stimulus package, like the one we're talking about, will be able to give that shot in the arm, that boost to the economy.
Amid growing fears of recession, lawmakers and the White House are trying to move quickly towards approval of an economic stimulus package. Considerable speculation is swirling around a taxpayer rebate to boost the sagging economy. The leading Democratic presidential candidates engaged in an often contentious and sometimes bitter debate last night in advance of their party's South Carolina primary. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards traded barbs over past votes and statements made during the campaign. Clinton drew first blood when she sharply criticized Obama for his recent comments praising Ronald Reagan and Republican ideas.
You talked about Ronald Reagan being a transformative political leader. I did not mention his name.
Your husband did.
Well, I'm here. He's
okay,
not.
Okay, well, and I can't tell who I'm running against sometimes.
Well.
The economy, health care, Iraq, and running against Republicans were among the issues debated. And a would-be car thief is in the hospital after being shot by a gun-toting 85-year-old grandfather. Florentino Wariga told police he had to react when he walked outside his Florida home and saw his suspect struggling with his son. The white-haired man then pulled out his handgun and wounded the suspects. Officials say Guarigi will most likely not be charged since he was trying to protect his son from bodily injury. Guarigi once served as a police officer in pre-Castro Cuba. And now your fascinating fact for the day. 96% of candles that are purchased in the United States are purchased by women. Shocking. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. We're looking at the 29th anniversary of the release of the Iranian hostages. Join me right now, Deborah Johanyak. She is the author of Behind the Veil. It's her memoir of the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, and published by University of Akron Press. Dr. Johanyak was raised in Akron, Ohio, and her graduate studies included a year in Iran where she held a teaching assistantship and witnessed the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. And Deborah, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, tell me what you were doing there. You were teaching. And how close were you to the compound? When did you hear about it? Set it up for me.
Okay, I was there teaching at the University of Shiraz, which is about 600 miles south of Tehran. We had lived in Tehran for a while and moved south to be close to my husband's family. And so being at the university, we heard a lot of the rumors and, you know, the different things going on around the country, the tension and pressure that was building. And so we just wondered what was going to happen. And when the news finally hit on November 4th, you know, it was on the radio, later on the television, and it was quite a shock. And we hope that the hostages would be released soon. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Had you planned to stay in Iran?
Yes, we did. I was married to an Iranian, mm-hmm. and we lived with his family. We had two young children. And I actually liked the country very much. His family was wonderful to us, and they accepted us and just made things comfortable and made us feel very welcome. But when this happened, we, you know, realized we had to rethink all of our plans, and we weren't sure how long we'd be able to stay.
No, I can imagine. You recognize that this was a momentous event then?
Yes, we did.
Well, this was the breaking of diplomatic boundaries that we rarely see.
It was a critical global event, and then following that, there was a series of assaults against U.S. embassies across the Middle East and some other parts of the country. So we knew this had touched off, an inflammatory type situation, which we just weren't sure, you know, when it would be contained or how it might resolve.
Now, how did you stay on top of information? How did you get information?
Well, I went to the newsstand, and I was able to get Western publications like Time Magazine and Newsweek in English. I also listened to the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, on the radio, and I followed some of the Iranian publications and television news reports as well. And, of course, there's always the rumor mill through the university and various, you know, community sources.
Mm-hmm. And did you have the impression originally that this was something that was a spontaneous event among students, or were they acting with the knowledge of Ayatollah Khomeini?
Well, we thought that it probably had evolved pretty randomly. There had been an earlier situation, what they used to call a sit-in at the embassy, back mm-hmm. in, I think, March of that year.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the Ayatollah had ordered the release of the hostages within hours, and so the students complied. And we were hoping this would be another such situation, but as it evolved, it turned out that it was going to become more government-sponsored, and it certainly had to play out much longer.
When did it first dawn on you that this was not going to be like the March sit-in?
Probably after the first week or two, we began to hear rumors that some of the hostages would be released, specifically the women and the African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that was hopeful, but it also suggested there were limits on who would be released. And going into the holiday season, we hoped that might be another occasion for mm-hmm. goodwill exchanges and, you know, the release of the pressure, but that just didn't happen.
Well, you were living there at the time of this remarkable ferment in Iran. Did you believe that you would be there to help Iran form a new direction after the exile of the Shah?
Well, my husband and I had actually been pretty unpolitical up to that point.
Okay.
His family, some of them at least, were practicing Muslims, and others were sort of apolitical like us. But we thought that, you know, with my teaching at the university and he was building roads and buildings, that we would be part of sort of a forward-looking aspect of culture. And we, you know, we're happy to be part of that.
Sure. When did it occur to you that maybe that wasn't the direction it was going?
Well, probably right after Christmas that year, it began to look pretty bleak. Russia had invaded Afghanistan, I believe, the day after Christmas.
Right.
And going into the new year, Time named Khomeini Man of the Year, and we thought that seemed a little unusual. And then Iran held its first...
Unusual meaning what, ominous?
Yes, I guess there was some uncertainty because we thought, were they doing this to placate him? Or, you know, why would they name this person, you know, as Man of the Year with the tense relations between the two countries?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then in January, Iran had its first presidential election, and I felt very good about taking part in that as President Abolhassan Banisadr mm-hmm. Was elected president. And he was considered a moderate, and we hoped that he would be able to make the hostage situation a priority mm-hmm. and perhaps organize their release in the near future.
Yeah. Whatever became of him?
Well, eventually he was, you know, replaced in office or taken out of office about a year and a half later. So... I don't know what he's doing now, but he certainly lost his place in the government.
Yeah. This was, is it fair to characterize this as America's first modern encounter with militant Islam?
It seems like it certainly was on a large scale. As you probably know, back, or have heard, at least back in 1953, both the U.S. CIA forces and some British special forces had gotten involved in ensuring that the Shah stayed in control of Iran because of America's, the West's interest in the oil there and so on, and stability in the region. And because of their involvement, that created a lot of bad feeling among various groups within Iran. And I think that fermented over a period of time, probably the next 25 years, and that kind of culminated in the hostage situation.
So that event, the shoring up of the Shah over against the People's Choice, I can't, I'm trying to remember his name now, Maladek or something.
Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, yes.
Yeah, well, that's the Shah's name. I was thinking, who was the fellow that was...
The one that they tried to elect as a Democratic, that was Mossadegh.
Mossadegh, that's right.
Yeah.
This is something that fermented from that time on then.
Yeah.
So this is this didn't start with the exile of the Shah or the return of Ayatollah Khomeini.
No, I think the Shah brought some reforms to Iran that many people did welcome, you know, some progress, some westernization. But other people felt that there was corruption within his government. They felt that, you know, the reforms that were promised didn't always pan out. And some people wanted to adhere to the traditional ways, and those actually became illegal after a time. So there was a lot of, you know, uncertainty, a lot of accusations, criticisms that the Shah was, you know, the U.S. puppet and that sort of thing.
Right.
So Iran felt that it was cheated of the chance to have its own organic democracy in 53 and then instead had this monarchy foisted on them by the U.S. So that continued to create ill will.
Were you living there when President Carter gave that really over-the-top toast to the Shah and calling him the best friend America ever had, speaking about how gracious he was? I mean, looking back on it now, it's an outrageous statement.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious what the reaction was to Carter in Iran.
I don't think I was in the country at the time.
At that moment, okay.
But there was a lot of, you know, acrimony against Carter and what his, really what the government represented. The people told me time and again, they were open to the American people. They wanted to be friends and have partnerships with us, but they had problems with the government.
You didn't feel under siege?
No, I really didn't. There were a couple of isolated situations because I didn't wear the veil.
Okay.
I really struggled with that. But generally, the people were just very hospitable and welcoming.
What's the story behind the veil? How did you understand it? Why did you choose not to wear it?
Well, you know, I was a young girl then, more or less, my early 20s, and just gotten out of college, and had a lot of feminist teachings back in the 70s, and felt that, you know, going abroad, that I should be sort of respected and accepted for who I was. And I was pretty naive and possibly a little arrogant at that time, but since the country was just sort of undergoing a change in regime, a lot of the Iranian girls didn't wear veils either. So, especially some of the younger ones like me, we just decided we don't really have to. We'll push it as far as we can go and kind of resist and be our own person.
Was that a mistake?
I think it was, in hindsight, because my husband's family was so gracious. Rather than confronting me and saying, look, you could put us all in trouble for refusing to wear the veil, they would just, you know, very gently and subtly, for example, took me to have some shirts made for teaching at the university, some blouse, long blouse-type shirts. And they were Islamic style, but you wouldn't know that. Even today, if I were to show them to someone, you'd never think they were Islamic style. They were pretty nice-looking shirts, long sleeve, you know, and a decent neckline. And it was their way to try to get me to stop wearing short sleeves. And then my sister-in-law, Patty, gave me a veil for Christmas. And, you know, I felt very honored that she remembered and honored our holiday of Christmas because we did celebrate it there. And yet it was sort of a gentle hint that, you know, you need this.
I can't imagine what was going through your mind at that time. Talk about mixed feelings.
That's right.
What's the theology or the cultural ideology behind the veil?
Well, it actually does have a lot of cultural ramifications. For example, I visited a Christian church there, and most of the women were either wore headscarves or wore veils.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that it's sort of a cultural thing to be covered, you know, to cover yourself in
sure.
modesty, not just religious belief.
Right. Right.
And then the Quran really doesn't mention veiling. It mentions that both men and women need to dress modestly in public.
Mm-hmm.
So Iran adopted the veil, and certainly countries like Saudi Arabia have taken that to the next step even.
Right. So there are a variety of ways that different Muslim groups embody this teaching on modesty.
That's right.
Okay. Deborah, hold it there. We'll come back on the other side of the break, continue the conversation.
All right.
My guest is Deborah Johanyak. She is the author of Behind the Veil, an American woman's memoir of the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. I'm Al Cresta. More coming up in just a moment.
From real estate to plumbing, from pet care to dentistry, Catholic business professionals are finding increased business when advertising with the Catholic Business Pages. For more information about advertising or to get your free copy, go to CatholicBusinessPages.com or call 734-930-4536. Get better results when you advertise. CatholicBusinessPages.com is brought to you this week by Midas, products and services you can trust. Midas is proud to sponsor the Catholic Business Pages and WDEO Catholic Radio. Midas provides total car care, from brakes to exhaust systems, starters, shocks, and struts. When you need a repair or preventative maintenance, call Midas. You can trust the Midas Touch. Call 1-800-GO-MIDAS. That's 1-800-GO-MIDAS. Or visit us online at Midas.com. CatholicBusinessPages.com, your best choice.
You now have two great Detroit area locations for religious merchandise. There's A. Mutea Church Supply in Garden City and now G.A. Fuchs Church Supply in Madison Heights. Between the two stores, they offer the largest selection of religious merchandise in southern Michigan, with everything from statuary, rosaries, and crucifixes to a large inventory of books. If you need it for your religious group or services, they have it. A. Mutea and G.A. Fuchs Church Supply. Just choose the location closest to you. You'll find A. Mutea Church Supply on Ford Road, just east of Merriman Road in Garden City. If you'd like to call for more information, the number is 734-513-2950. Write it down, 734-513-2950. If you're closer to Madison Heights, you can stop at G.A. Fuchs Church Supply on Stevenson Highway, just south of 14 Mile Road, off I-75. You can call them at 248-589-0200. You'll want to write that one down, too. 248-589-0200. They look forward to serving you.
I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Deborah Johanyak. She is the author of Behind the Veil, an American woman's memoir of the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. We're looking at the 29th anniversary of the release of the hostages. What were you able to continue your teaching position?
Well, I did up until the end of the fall semester, and then we had a few weeks of break. But an interesting thing happened at the beginning of the spring break when we went to give the placement exam on the first day of classes, the other graduate students and instructors and I, and several Revolutionary Guards came on campus with their flak jackets and their guns, and they began yelling at the students and telling them, you know, milling around outside of the campus, do not go in, sit down, take the exams, this is imperialist literature, you're being influenced by the West. And so they wouldn't let them sit for the exam. So our department chair came rushing through the building, said emergency meeting, second floor of the building, arts and sciences building, and so we hurried and met him up there. Well, then the Revolutionary Guards brought a contingent of students and stormed the building where we were at. And for some reason, that conference room door had a lock on it. And we put it to use that day, and they began pounding on the door and insisting, you know, we open and yelling, and I was really pretty fearful of what was going to happen, but I knew it was a relatively small and isolated group of extremists, but I just wasn't sure whether we would be taken hostages as well. So as it turned out, we had a very diplomatic professor there whom everybody liked and respected, and he insisted on slipping out and talking with the agitated group a couple of times, actually, and they yelled, and, you know, it was pretty loud from inside the conference room, what we were able to hear, but he did manage to get them to quiet down, and the second time he got them to leave, and he told us when he came back to the room, now you hurry and go home, because I don't know if they're coming back. So we all did, but at that point, the university went on strike. The students went on strike, and it stayed out of order for a while, and then shortly after that, the Iran-Iraq war began. So it was some time before things really organized into, you know, an orderly format again to start having classes.
When did you, was that a watershed moment for you in terms of your own sense of personal safety?
It was, because even though I realized it was a small group, and there had been some other isolated incidents as well, a group of women had, you know, kind of, they wore the heavy dark chadors, which there were different types, but theirs was the darkest and most conservative. And chador means veil. They got off the bus behind me and, you know, called to me, why don't you go home and put on a veil? And I said, but why should I when I'm not Islamic? And I didn't mean it in a, you know, a rude way, but it probably came across that way. And then there was some sort of threatening writing on the orchard wall in red paint. Women who don't wear veils are such and such, and men who don't make them are pigs. And I began to feel like, you know, there was some, you know, tensions building there that may or may not be directed against me personally in our neighborhood. And then I was almost assaulted by a guy on a bike, and we, you know, got a couple rats in the house, and I had to fight those. And there was a sandstorm, so
a sandstorm.
As things began building, I just thought maybe it's time to go home for a while.
How did your husband respond to these attacks on you?
Well, he worked out of town, and he was only home on weekends, which in the Middle East is Thursday and Friday. So I would tell him, and he would advise me, you know, stay out of here, don't go there. And, you know, of course I knew then to go out with other women, usually his sisters, and they were very good to go with me. But he was sort of a nonchalant person, and I don't think he realized either, you know, some of the potential problems that could have been really pretty dangerous.
Now, did you, at that point, were you a Muslim? No, you weren't a Muslim.
No. No, I wasn't, actually.
What was your spiritual background?
Well, as a child, I was baptized, and it was actually, I think, a non-denominational church. And I'd always believed in God, but I had not always walked with him during my teen years. And then I ended up in this, you know, this cross-cultural marriage. And as I say, my husband was not really political or religious, and I wasn't really very active in my faith either. But what was interesting is being in Iran, I saw many people who were devout Muslims. And I was so impressed with the way they lived their faith, quietly and piously and respect to others and caring for their families. I thought, you know, I want that in my life. And I had to rethink my spiritual roots, got back into the Bible, and there I was.
So did you, would you say you had an adult conversion to Christianity or to Christ?
Yes, I would call it I guess it would be a conversion or a recommitment. And then when I ended up coming back to the States and with our two young sons, I got involved in the local church and just continued to grow since that time.
Did you have much opportunity during your time in Iran to engage your relatives or neighbors or coworkers in discussion about spiritual truths?
Well, we did. My closest sister-in-law was Patty, and she was very, you know, militant Muslim almost, not dangerously or, you know, where she would go hurt somebody, but I mean, she would march in protest. She read her Quran, but she was a very devout, simple soul. And she and I would often have discussions. She would tell me what she had heard of the Bible, and I would ask her questions about the Quran. And we never really, I don't think, tried to convert each other. I mean, I would have liked that, but I knew better than to try to press her too much. But we respected each other's views and remained good friends. And what's interesting, though, is because I did get to share my faith with other family members from time to time, is even now, even just last week or the week before, I got an email from someone, and it was my husband's brother, actually, his older brother, and he said, I know Jesus is watching over you.
Oh, yeah.
So, and he, you know, from a Muslim, I think that's pretty nice.
That is nice, yeah. So you, in the midst of that conflict, you were able to go back and draw upon the resources of your own spiritual background.
Yes.
Okay. And you didn't feel threatened for being a Christian per se?
Well, no, because for one thing, my looks are such that I could pass for Iranian, although I didn't deliberately try to, but mm-hmm. even some of my students would say, oh, you're just Iranian trying to pass yourself off as American. So I don't think I stuck out as like some people do, and, you know, or would have looked more obvious out of place there. And as I say, I mean, really the people are very generous and mm-hmm. hospitable and respectful there overall.
Now, when you look at what's going on today between the United States and Iran, what do you think, how do you characterize this relationship?
Well, in my opinion, I think that both sides have tried to reach out from time to time, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, and it seems like they can't seem to reach out at the same time, you know, and get to the negotiation table in a gracious way that would allow for give and take of discussion and apologies and, you know, building partnerships for the future. But I really believe that's possible. There's a very helpful website and organization called the American-Iranian Council,
mm-hmm.
and they also believe and have organized various events involving Madeleine Albright, for example, mm-hmm. and Senator Chuck Hagel and various others, that with some orchestration, that maybe we can get the right people to sit down and start talking to each other, and then we can resolve some of these.
Try to sort out for me the difference between Sunni and Shiite. And especially in Iraq, which has a majority Sunni population, a minority Sunni population, a majority Shiite population. And how likely is it, from what you saw, that Iranian Shiites would find common cause with Iraqi Shiites? Or are the differences in culture, Persian versus Arab, so different that they're not apt to have common cause?
Well, the only commonality they would have is the core belief in Islam and biblically, Quran teachings as well. But actually, Iran was settled by the Aryan people about 3,000 years ago, so they're not an Arab people.
Right.
And their language is different. It's an Indo-European language. Mm-hmm. It's not an Arabic language. So culturally, certainly there is some influences from Arabic culture surrounding them, and there are affinities there, but there is a distinct Iranian culture, and I believe it's unique in that region in many ways.
The Iraqi Shiites, though, are largely Arab, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Shiites are different because they have a more like, sort of like a philosophical approach to their faith, whereas mm-hmm. I think Sunni is more like a practical, you know, how to interpret this and that on a lifestyle type mm-hmm. basis. That's mm-hmm. my general understanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you anticipate that the United States will be able to establish diplomatic relations with Iran?
Well, I think it's possible. I think both sides would like to see that happen. It's just, you know, the mechanism of how it's going to be done that's the challenge, I believe. So as you may have heard recently, there are some companies currently even doing business with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it looks like Iran has lived up to some of its promises or Western expectations of it, that mm-hmm. it sort of decreased the building of missiles and
right.
supplying Afghanistan or Pakistan and so on, Iraq. So I think possibly, as you know, some of these agreements begin to surface and that they are working to a certain extent, maybe there's more hope.
Of the leaders that Iran has had since the Ayatollah Khomeini and since the Islamic Revolution, are there any? Do any of them stand out as having been more conciliatory or congenial to the United States?
Well, it seems to me, you know, you hear different rhetoric at different times.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that Ali Khamenei, not Khomeini, but Khamenei,
mm-hmm.
May have had that in the back of his mind from some of the things he has said and done. And he still, I believe, continues to have some influence in the Council of Guardians. So, you know, it's possible that that will pan out eventually.
Mm-hmm. what do you make of the current President Ahmadinejad's comments about the Jews?
Well, I didn't hear them directly, and I don't know what kind of translation they went through,
yeah.
So it's hard
okay.
to say for sure. But it sounds, of course, like they're pretty ludicrous to say
yeah.
that to even suggest that the Holocaust didn't occur, or, you know, of course, the whole Middle Eastern perspective on Israel is that it shouldn't exist.
Right.
But one translation discrepancy I heard about, both of them through Western media, was that, for example, one source reported that the president said Israel should be blown off the face of the earth. But the way that another media source translated it was Israel will disappear into the pages of time.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very different. I mean, it's the same outcome, essentially, but one is suggesting it could happen of its own accord, and the other suggesting that mm-hmm. terrorist action would be responsible. So I would say that you know, the president has apologized for some of the comments he's made, and surely I think he realizes now they were totally, you know, off base. And I think that even some of the Ayatollahs in the background have reined him in a bit. So I'm hoping they'll take a more moderate stance, and as I'm hoping all the Middle East will, and recognize mm-hmm. Israel.
Yeah. Well, is anti-Semitism common in Iran?
Well, I did hear occasional comments, although I didn't see anything large scale. For example, somebody said in passing, it was somebody I think from one of the villages we met, that Jewish people are afraid of fire. I mean, that's kind of a stereotypical thing. I don't know where it comes from, but obviously it's ridiculous.
Actually, I've never heard that before. So.
No, I hadn't either, and I, of course, I didn't respond at all, but that's about the extent of it.
Yeah.
I've had discussions with people at the university level and so on just about, you know, sometimes they're irritated because the United States will support what they view as Israel's terrorism,
right.
but then the United States stands up against Arab nations' so-called terrorism. So they feel there's an injustice there. At least some people do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to, Deborah, thank you very much for being with me today and for sharing your memoir.
Thank you.
And I hope we can talk again in the future.
All right. Thanks very much.
Behind the Veil, an American woman's memoir of the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. Deborah Jahanyak, published by University of Akron Press. Coming up in just a minute, we're going to talk with Dr. Bali Nasser, adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, about the Shia revival and how conflicts within Islam will shape the future of democracy.
Deacon Alex Jones rounds out our attendance at the Transfiguration Parish Mission on our next Putting on the Mind of Christ.
Through every age, through every generation, he has raised up a people to minister to that generation, to dispense his graces, to dispense his love, to dispense his justice, to dispense his peace. And therefore, we are, as Jesus called us, the salt of the earth. We are that salt, that body of people that bring about goodness in the earth, that bring about love in the earth, and so much hatred. But we, in spite of that, bring faith, we bring hope, we bring love, we bring justice, we bring peace to each generation.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. We finish up our participation at the Transfiguration Parish Mission with Deacon Alex Jones' closing talk. We'll also contribute to the pro-life events going on around the country with some local coverage. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
At Ave Maria Mutual Funds, investing is far more than a numbers game. Investment performance is of utmost importance, and equally so are issues such as abortion and pornography. Chances are, these are important to you as well. To learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Fund's pro-life investing strategies and our investment results, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA, or visit www.avemariafunds.com. Ave Maria Mutual Funds can help you feel good about your investment decisions, smart investing, and Catholic values. Performance data quoted represents past performance, which is no guarantee of future results. Investment return and principal value are historical and may fluctuate so that the redemption value may be worth more or less the original cost. Prospective investors should read the prospectus carefully and consider the fund's investment objectives, risk, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. The prospectus, which can be obtained by calling 1-866-AVE-MARIA or online at AveMariaFund.com, contains this and other information. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has said that Iran constitutes the single most important single country strategic challenge to the United States and to the kind of Middle East that we want to see. It seems as though nobody denies the future importance of Iran to U.S. foreign policy. With me right now to talk about this, as well as the Shia revival, is Dr. Vali Nasser, Adjunct Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, Professor of International Politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy of Tufts University. He's the author of a number of books, including The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future, and just read an article by him in the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs called The Costs of Containing Iran, Washington's Misguided New Middle East Policy. And Dr. Nasser, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Has the Bush administration's toppling of Saddam Hussein liberated and empowered Iraq's Shiite majority?
Well, that it clearly has. In other words, this was a majority of the population that was not well represented in the halls of power in Iraq. And since the fall of the regime and through the elections and their participation in the political process that the United States brought to Iraq, they have assumed a large portion of the government. So the prime minister, the majority in the parliament, as well as the majority of the cabinet are constituted of Shias, and particularly those Shia factions that were opposed to Saddam Hussein, most of whom were in exile, a number of them in Iran, and now increasingly also in southern Iraq as part of the new surge strategy. The Shia political parties, and particularly one of them, is collaborating with the U.S. The Shia militias, one of the major ones, the Badr Corps, is joining the Iraqi security forces. So they are, by and large, now in the driver's seat, both in Baghdad and in southern Iraq.
Now, how do they relate to the Shia of Iran?
Well, there are cultural and religious ties in the same manner as you might say there is the same religion in, say, Catholics in Italy and Catholics in Ireland.
Okay.
But what makes it relevant is that you have a civil war in Iraq, a conflict over who will own Iraq's future, which pits the Sunni minority that used to rule on Iraq and whose political position is supported by Iraq's Arab neighbors, vis-a-vis the Shia, who have now political, military ties with Iran and who rely on Iran in supporting him in this ongoing civil war. So for so long as the future of Iraq is uncertain, the Shiites in Iraq rely on the country with whom they have cultural relations, which many of their leaders of the Shias in Iraq spent exile time in Iran,
mm-hmm.
and they have been receiving material and military support from Iran in this struggle for control of Iraq.
This has got to be a bit confusing, given that the United States seems to have a policy of trying to contain Iran by encouraging Sunni Arab states to see Iran as a threat. How does this work with the EU? How does this help the United States with the Shiites of Iran? Of Iraq.
It doesn't. The problem comes from the fact that the Taliban that the United States toppled in Afghanistan and the Saddam regime that the United States toppled in Iraq were both enemies of Iran. So in very peculiar way, the interests of the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan for a period of time were the same. In other words, they were both opposed to these regimes, the Taliban and Saddam. And the U.S. and Iran found themselves both supporting the forces that came to power after these regimes were toppled. And this actually helped Iran become stronger in the region because Iran's enemies fell in Kabul and Baghdad and Iran's friends came to power. The United States has been trying to roll back this situation since 2003, and it has been trying to rally Arab governments to join the United States in a united front to contain Iran. But the problem is that the Arab governments that the United States wants support of in Iraq don't support the Shia government that the United States is supporting.
Right, right. I mean,
so that has been one of the problems of trying to make some kind of coherence between United States-Iraq policy and United States-Iran policy.
How big a threat is Iran when it comes to nuclear weapons?
Well, Iran's threat to its neighbors and the United States is at multi-level. Obviously, Israel and the United States view Iran's nuclear program as the greatest threat. Israel also views Iran's support for Hamas and Hezbollah as a threat. The Arab governments who are in the Persian Gulf area also view the rising Iranian power, Iran's naval presence, Iran's willingness to assert its role in Afghanistan and Iraq in the Palestinian issue as a threat to their power and position. There is no doubt that everybody sees Iran essentially more powerful today than it was in 2003. This has to do with the weakening of Iraq. It has to do with the nuclear issue. It has to do with Iranian role in Lebanon and the Palestinian issue. I think there is no doubt that there is a very clear perception that Iran's power is bigger than it was, and the Arab governments would like to contain and control it. Israel would like to contain and control it, and the United States wants to contain and control it. Now, this whole game of controlling Iran obviously is mostly focused on the nuclear issue because that's of the single biggest issue on the table and potentially the greatest threat. Iran currently is not in a position to deliver a nuclear weapon. It's rather trying to build the capability and acquire the knowledge that could potentially put it in a position that it would be able to acquire nuclear capability in the future. So the name of the game is try to prevent Iran from getting to that point, and that's why there is so much pressure on Iran stopping its research into enrichment.
We often heard said that Iran and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has been targeted as a terrorist group, that Iran's been supporting terrorism in Iraq, it's been supporting Hezbollah. How, in your estimation, how serious a claim is that?
Well, there is a lot of truth to it in the sense that Iran does support Hezbollah. Iran has been involved in the Palestinian issue and has supported Islamic Jihad and also Hamas. And Iran is supporting militias in southern Iraq. However, Iran's behavior in the region becomes more problematic because it's in the context of the greater problem between U.S. and Iran, two countries that do not have relations, now are at loggerheads over Iran's nuclear issue, and also that the United States and its allies in the Arab world are uncomfortable with the assertive role that Iran is playing. Iran is part of the security issues that the United States is trying to deal with in the whole Middle East, but it is not the entire problem. In other words, some of the issues that have to do with Al-Qaeda, with insurgents in Iraq, don't have to do with Iran. But when you connect the larger issue of Iranian power play in the region to the nuclear issue and then to these other arenas in which Iran is active, it becomes a far broader Middle East-wide issue in the eyes of the United States.
You've written about an entire book, The Shia Revival, and how conflict within Islam will shape the future. Is this branch of Islam the most culturally creative at this point?
In the past years, it has been for the reason that within Iran itself, you have a theocratic government that, as a result, has produced a democratic opposition. And therefore, you have a very fertile debate within Iran about religious reform, about nature of power. And within Iraq also, you have had some serious debates since 2003 about relationship of religion to constitution and the like. And generally, the structure of Shia law also is permissive of much more detailed debate on these issues. And I think in many ways, particularly because the Iranian political scene and cultural scene is so alive with debates around varieties of issues, and particularly political issues, you have a lot more dynamism in the Shia world than you have in the Sunni world. After all, it is in the Shia world that you have the only Islamic government, as a result of which you have a population that is no longer really concerned with Islam being a solution to a host of problems and wants to get past this period of Islam and politics to what comes next, which is really the debate in Iran. So you have a very interesting intellectual, some of whom are in the West, some are still in Iran, who are writing about changes in Islamic law, changes in Islamic government, and the like. And some of this debate is seeping to the Arab world as well.
Yes, but the Islamic character of Iran is considered a settled issue, so they can go on to debate exactly what that character might become.
That's true, but you know, in the Arab world you have secular governments. As a result, all political debate is Islamic. In Iran you have an Islamic government, so a lot of the political debate is non-Islamic and secular. And it's not that the Iranian, it's that every, you know, dictatorship essentially breeds the nature of the debate against it. And as a consequence, because the Iranian dictatorship is theocratic, a lot of the debate in Iran is no longer focused on the merits of Islamic State and Islamic government, but really wants to take Iran to what comes after.
Now, is Iran seeking to create disorders so it can fulfill some kind of eschatological promise, or is it an expansionist power with unquenchable ambitions? Or is it just trying to, you know, become a pivotal state in the Middle East?
I don't think that, you know, there is much to the eschatological argument. I mean, there is no evidence of it that the Iranian regime would like to see the world end. They rather want to rule over the region. They want to expand their power. They want to assert their policies on their neighbors. They want to play a bigger role in the destiny of the Middle East than they have. They want to have a seat at the Palestinian issue in Lebanon, in Iraq. They want to consolidate the gains that they have made, and they want to intimidate their neighbors to accept Iran's greater power play. In some arenas, they cooperate with their neighbors. In other arenas, they create mischief. You have a similar policy vis-a-vis the United States. At the same time, as some, as for varieties of reasons, they've decided to reduce tensions in Iraq, they may engage in some adventures over the naval issues in the Gulf. Iran is an opportunistic state, and it thinks that right now in the chaos of the Middle East, it has elbow room to expand its influence and to be able to consolidate power. It very clearly understands that there is a political vacuum in Iraq, there's a political vacuum in Afghanistan, that there is no military other than the United States in the Persian Gulf to contain it. So in many ways, it is Iran's moment to get more and to have more and to influence more than it did in the past.
Have you had a chance to advise this administration?
Not recently, but in the past I have talked with people in the administration.
What would you advise? President calls you tomorrow. What would you tell him about Iran? What do you want to do?
Well, Iran presents a very complicated situation. I mean, without a doubt, handling Iran is the single biggest challenge facing this administration and the next. But it is not a problem that can be handled with a silver bullet policy, that we have to have a much more long-run, patient strategy of how to influence Iranian behavior and manage its role in the region.
Let's talk again, Dr. Nasser. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Vali Nasser from Foreign Affairs Magazine, Cost of Containing Iran.
The Ave Maria CD library continues to grow. To complement Father Ricardo's 17 CD set on the rite of Christian initiation for adults, we've repackaged his 8 CD series on the Ten Commandments. The 3-volume RCIA series is $125, and the Ten Commandments set is $68. The MP3 CDs are $70 and $30, respectively. All editions of Crest in the Afternoon, Catholic Connection, Putting on the Mind of Christ, The Doctor is In, and Heart, Mind, and Strength are also available. All single talks and programs are on high-quality CDs and are $8.50 each. To place your order for one of these talks or to inquire about a talk topic of interest to you, call 734-930-4506. 734-930-4506 or write orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
From real estate to plumbing, from pet care to dentistry, Catholic business professionals are finding increased business when advertising with the Catholic Business Pages. For more information about advertising or to get your free copy, go to CatholicBusinessPages.com or call 734-930-4536. Get better results when you advertise. CatholicBusinessPages.com is brought to you this week by Midas, products and services you can trust. Midas is proud to sponsor the Catholic Business Pages and WDEO Catholic Radio. Midas provides total car care, from brakes to exhaust systems, starters, shocks, and struts. When you need a repair or preventative maintenance, call Midas. You can trust the Midas Touch. Call 1-800-GO-MIDAS. That's 1-800-GO-MIDAS. Or visit us online at Midas.com. CatholicBusinessPages.com, your best choice.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Coming up in the next hour, a look at the March for Life in Washington, D.C. Our friend Teresa Tomeo will be joining us, telling us what's happening there on the steps of the Supreme Court. Also, in the next hour, we'll be taking a look at a lay Catholic response to the so-called call for civility that was published a few weeks ago. It's like, you know, a call for peace or... Who can disagree with civility? Who can disagree with peace? The question is, what does such a call mean? Austin Roos will tell us in the next hour. Also, with the stock market up and down and interest rates falling, we'll talk to George Schwartz. President
Cresta in the Afternoon is produced and distributed by Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The executive producer is Nick Tong. The technical engineer, Kara Coulter. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To order your copy of this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
You now have two great Detroit area locations for religious merchandise. There's A. Mutea Church Supply in Garden City and now G.A. Fuchs Church Supply in Madison Heights. Between the two stores, they offer the largest selection of religious merchandise in southern Michigan, with everything from statuary, rosaries, and crucifixes to a large inventory of books. If you need it for your religious group or services, they have it. A. Mutea and G.A. Fuchs Church Supply. Just choose the location closest to you. You'll find A. Mutea Church Supply on Ford Road, just east of Merriman Road in Garden City. If you'd like to call for more information, the number is 734-513-2950. Write it down, 734-513-2950. If you're closer to Madison Heights, you can stop at G.A. Fuchs Church Supply on Stevenson Highway, just south of 14 Mile Road, off I-75. You can call them at 248-589-0200. You'll want to write that one down, too. 248-589-0200. They look forward to serving you.
Father Benedict Groeschel and EWTN's Jeanette Bankovic are some of the speakers participating in the 11th Annual Holy Trinity Apostolate Lenten Symposium. Love One Another is on February 23rd at St. Cyril and Methodius in Sterling Heights. Holy Mass begins at 8 a.m. with the Most Reverend Daniel E. Flores and closes with benediction from the Most Reverend John Quinn at 4. Speakers include, direct from Rome, Reverend Monsignor Charles Mangan on Mary's Sacrifices.